trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a well, it's a day, Don, and it's cloudy. It's overcast. The high is going to be in the 70s. I am so confused.
We are having lively and interesting weather in Northern California this week. For the last week, it's been substantially cooler than average. We had warm, overcast with a little rain. That is a very relevant factor for gardeners that we'll definitely be talking about more as we get into the program. Lois and I are preparing the show on September 2 for broadcast on September 3, 2026. And the high today is going to be 77 degrees. 77 degrees. So I bumped over to Weather Spark to see what our average high for today would be.
And on my computer, it says it's going to be 79 and the high is 91.
Would be the average. Yeah, the
average 91. High is 91.
77 today. So you know what it's going to be tomorrow on Thursday? The day of the broadcast will be 72 degrees and a slight chance of rain. Mostly clear.
Oh, God, is it really fall or is this just a blip?
It has very much felt like fall. One of my staff has been using the term false fall when people are coming in, walking in, going, well, where are your flower bulbs? I'm ready to plant cover crops. We're perfectly happy to see that enthusiasm. And there's probably nothing wrong with planting some of those things, assuming that it stays at least relatively mild. But it is funny how people have just suddenly, you know, pivoted over to fall stuff. They're looking for broccoli and cauliflower. That's great. Nurseries and hardware stores all have brassicas in now. I'm holding off on some of the lettuces and things because I would remind you all that September can be a very hot month in the Sacramento Valley. The most extreme heat event we've ever had here that since I moved here was in September a couple of years ago when it was 7 days in a row, 116, 116, 110, 110, 106, 106, 106. 7 days in a row in September. I think that was 2022 or 2023. And that broke every record you can think of. Highest temperature ever, highest number of days in September, et cetera. So we can be hot and dry and windy in September. People keep asking, is it okay to plant now? Yes, but of course we can get dry, hot, windy weather in September. And
it's always a risk.
It's a risk.
It's always a risk, yeah.
Gardening is a risk.
That's what I mean. No matter when you plant, you risk something.
Right. So early planting on these brassicas, like we've talked about for the last couple of weeks, is fine. I planted some 2 weeks ago. They look great. We're a little worried about leafy greens still, although we're bringing some in because people want to try them. With a little light shade, they're probably fine, and they'll probably establish fine, even if we go back to higher temperatures. Main thing being, we don't see any higher temperatures in the immediate forecast. So Friday is going to be 77, Friday night 54 and clear, Saturday 81 and sunny, Saturday night 55 and clear, Sunday 83 and sunny, Sunday night mostly clear, low around 57, Labor Day sunny with a high near 86. Gosh, what a great day to be off work. Monday night, be a great day to be off work and go gardening. Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 60. And then we warm up mid part of next week. Tuesday is showing a high near 90. It was interesting this Sunday to be just checking in on Facebook periodically because there's four different meteorologists that I follow on Facebook. One's in the Pacific Northwest, one's in northwestern Northern California, one's in Southern California, and one does more national models. And they all started about 3-4 o'clock Sunday afternoon, started popping up with, whoa, look at this. Wow, tropical storm may go over California. And it was, I zoomed over to ventusky.com, which I highly recommend you do right now, ventusky.com, and back out to show the entire Pacific Ocean. There are indeed three tropical storms lined up aiming at, looks like, Baja California and Central America. And they do these models that do zillions of replications of possible outcomes. And a whole bunch of them were showing the possibility that one of those tropical storms could veer up over Southern California and could give you literally not a hurricane, but a tropical storm in September. in Southern California. And of course, the Southwest has been having significant flooding, tragic incidents in the Grand Canyon just in the last couple of days, for example. It is always possible if a storm goes into Southern California that it could even veer into the San Joaquin Valley. And in the years we've been here, it's occasionally come up into the Sacramento Valley. That would be very odd. But the U.S. National Weather Service in Hanford this morning posted an excellent summary. A trough in the northern portion of California is expected to bring rain chances to much of the San Joaquin Valley this weekend. Further south, Tropical Storm Marie may have some influence. So one coming from the south, one coming from the north. The track for the tropical storm is unknown after Sunday afternoon. Most models are projecting that the tropical storm will move out into the sea, so we wouldn't have that impact. However, there's a low probability but high impact model could bring increased rain to central and southern California if Tropical Storm Marie were to turn towards Baja, moving up into California. We will continue to monitor the situation. So they're basically just saying there is a track possible that could bring that over southern California, even into the San Joaquin Valley, and it's not unheard of for those to just slide right up the valley and give us some rain. We did see, it wasn't a tropical storm, but we did see that kind of warm, moist air earlier in the week. And unfortunately, that led to a variety of disease problems. But for the foreseeable predicted future, very mild temperatures, well below average for this time of year until the early to middle part of next week. Night temperatures are mid-50s, days are in the 70s to 80s. That really is ideal transplanting weather. And just so you understand why we're saying, you know, this is good, that isn't good, it's the 1 to 2 days after you plant something, really. 2 to 3 days, when you really have to be very, very close watch on the watering. It goes through a process of wilt. We used to call it transplant shock. I don't think that's really an accurate term. It's not a shock. The plant is simply responding to the fact that you broke off some of the roots when you put it in, and you took it from a nice protected environment, garden center, greenhouse, and you put it out in the open in your wild and woolly field, and all of a sudden it has to adapt to lower humidity, more wind, possibly higher temperatures, and you have to manage the soil moisture, and you've taken off part of the root system when you put it in. People are often concerned when they watch us prune roots at the time of planting. You know, you'll take a plant out of those little cell packs or a 3-inch pot, and they're just a mass of roots on the bottom. They'll watch me yank off a quarter of the roots, take my pruners and gash down the side to break up the roots that are circling. And they're, you know, the comment that people make when they're watching anyone who's done this, do this kind of severe root, seems severe root pruning, isn't that going to hurt the plant?
The circling roots, yes, will strangle themselves if you don't fix it. So you got to fix it.
You got to uncircle them or cut them or break them. And sometimes I'm literally taking something out of a gallon container and slicing off the bottom inch of the roots because they've gone to the bottom of the pot and circled and circled and circled. That'll set the plant back, even a bedding plant. And what really worries me the most are those little six packs. I'm not a fan of them. I understand the public likes them because they're cheap, but you're buying something where you're getting a little seedling in a like a 2-inch by 2-inch cube of soil. If this had been in the nursery for even a week or two too long, it's very root bound. You can correct that. If you don't, the plant won't establish well. You can correct it by teasing those roots apart, gently teasing them apart, or the more of them you do, the more you're likely to just yank them apart and you'll find it works. But there is a period of 1, 2, 3 days after you do that where the plant is likely to droop, especially the middle of the day, even if the soil has some moisture. So our dictum here at the Davis Garden Show is?
Check daily, water is needed.
Correct. And my experience. Oh, my
experience. Well, you have so many now, and it could have been anything.
True. That's one of our main aphorisms here. Check daily, water is needed. My experience is when you plant them out that way, there's a day of droop. Any water correctly, they perk back up. And within 2 to 3 days, they've gotten through that transplant shock, as they like to call it.
Well, the roots have grown because those, when you break off that little mass of roots in a 3-inch pot, the roots that are left aren't going to wither, die, and go back. They're just going to start growing new little roots from the roots that remain.
And they'll do it quickly if they're stressed. If the plant was really overgrown, then some of the older leaves will yellow and drop. But don't hesitate to cut those roots back. I have pulled out bedding plants at the end of the season, a petunia or something that never really grew very well. You pull it up and it's still shaped like a 4-inch pot. Those roots simply never got out. Yeah, they can stay alive, but they aren't going to perform all that well. So this goes for flowers. This goes for vegetables. Something that we can tell you from the retail standpoint is people like big plants that are blooming in containers, but it'd be a lot better to buy the smaller plant that just came in. If you've got, if you're at a garden center and there's big plants over there with flowers on them, or tomatoes that are starting to fruit, or, you know, brassicas that are 3-6 inches tall in the pot, those are root bound. Those are going to go through more of this transplant issue than would something that's a nice, young, healthy plant. But I can tell you regrettably that the public generally prefers bigger plants. They think they're getting more for their money. The problem is the root systems. What you really want more for your money with is the root system. I would think most vegetables, what we're finding is they do best from a quart pot size. But anyway, we've got some nice transplanting weather coming up, and a great time to start thinking about reseeding your lawn or planting a meadow or transplanting perennials, dividing them. And many people are going ahead and doing it, and I think it's absolutely fine. Just be aware that we could have a surge back to hot weather. But I will say this, generally speaking, when we have hot weather in September or October, the exception being a couple of years ago, it's not as pervasive, persistent, or extensive as it is when we have hot weather in, say, July. That was what was so shocking about that heat wave in September 2022, I'm pretty sure it was. And we're still seeing results from that. I mean, I was having a conversation with a lady a few weeks ago. Her nectarine was struggling. I asked her to take some pictures and bring them in. The entire side of that tree had been torched during that heat wave, and the tree was still recovering. And unfortunately, there were points of infestation. So that's a side note, but that extreme heat can occur. If we got something like that, I hate to say it, you might have to replant some of your vegetables.
Amateur Flower Farm, which is the Daylily Central, and it's a wonderful place, and they're going out of business. So, but they're open until, I guess it's the 12th. They're open 9 to 4 daily. There's a nursery there and a gift shop.
It's Amador County. It's a destination location. By the way, thank you very much to the owners of Amador Flower Farm. It's a wonderful venue. We had nursery association meetings out there way back when you guys first opened, all those many years ago. So we thank you. They wrote a note. We want to take a moment to thank all of our wonderful customers who have supported Amador Flower Farm throughout the years, the families who made the farm part of your traditions and celebrations. And we thank you, because I know starting that kind of a business out in the middle of nowhere is a real challenge. And that was, you really built something amazing out there. So thank you for what you've done over the years.
I want to foreshadow next week. Okay. And that is the California Coastal Cleanup Day is coming. Yep. And next week, I'll tell you all about what we're doing here in Davis. But if you want to get a jump on it, go to coastalcleanupday.org. And I'll tell you more next week.
But we're not on the coast.
I know. But we've got Davis. So next week, Don.
Okay.
Till next week. Other things that we have going are not quite this weekend, but coming up soon, we have Wildlife Wonders 2026.
Yeah.
What? Wildlife Wonders? Yes. Saturday, September 19th from 9 a.m. till noon. And it is the Sacramento Valley California Native Plant Society. And at their nursery, which is on 2140 Chase Drive, Rancho Cordova. That's a soil-borne farms is the name of the farm. But anyway, it's going to be celebrating native wildlife, biodiversity, and the remarkable relationships between wildlife and the plants they depend on. This is free. It's open to the public. It's got kid-friendly interactive exhibits. It's got a whole bunch of different stuff. You can visit their nursery.
Wildlife Wonders, Sac Valley, California Native Plant Society, Nursery and Gardens, 2140 Chase Drive in Rancho Cordova. This information is available at the Sacramento Valley, California Native Plant Society website, which is sacvalleycnps.org.
All right. What else have we got going here?
Well, there's all kinds of great programming here at KDRT. And while we often talk on this show about the other public affairs shows, there are great music shows that are broader than just music. And one of the long-running shows here on KDRT is Cowboy Tracks, where you can join Nancy around the campfire to hear authentic Western roots music and cowboy poetry. Something deep in your soul will resonate to stories from the early Wranglers, Mexican vaqueros, Old West adventurers, silver screen buckaroos, Western swing bands, contemporary real cowboys, and all who appreciate wide open spaces, freedom, and the Western lifestyle. That's live Wednesdays, 1 to 2 p.m., and a replay Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Cowboy Tracks, right here at KDRT.
So I want to thank those listeners who write in to tell us when there's a problem with the show. Well, you know, sometimes things happen.
we appreciate it when you bring these things to our attention. So there was a funny glitch last week's show. We answered a question about roses in woodland. And as I'm editing, I thought, I'm going to move this further back in the show. So I did. I copied it, cut it, and pasted it. Except that it was a two-part answer.
Second part.
And I left the second part in there. So we launched right into the second part. And if you were listening, it would be a little discombobulating because we were cogent without context. We made sense, but you didn't know what we were talking about. We were talking about the nice lady up in Woodland who had the rose problems. And we did fully answer that later in the show. So we did answer the question about roses in Woodland. So if you were still listening, you will hear the full answer there. More to the point, if you have any follow-up questions, don't hesitate to send them to us at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I did think of one added thing for that. The one thing you could do that would probably be really helpful is go out and buy a nozzle that goes on a garden hose that is adjustable from a jet spray to a dispersed spray. In other words, to wash things off as well as to water. And one of the best things you can do for your roses, not when we're having fungus weather, but perhaps when it's a little drier and sunnier, is take that out, wash each of these roses off really vigorously because there were mites and things on there, and then stand there. I timed myself on this for about 20 to 30 seconds, holding it straight on that plant. You'll actually put out 1 to 2 gallons of water when you do that. And it'll be one thorough soaking for that nice young plant that you just washed off. So you wash it off, stand there 20 to 30 seconds, move on to the next one. If you could do that once a week, so you use the jet spray for washing, then you turn it into more of a shower, you give it a shower. Once a week, I would guess those roses will start to come back very quickly. They may already have begun to do so, but that would get them going better. So that's just a $15 nozzle you can stick on the end of a hose. It should have an adjustable end that you can go from a shower to a jet spray. That jet spray is going to be your friend because that is what we're always telling you on the show to do, is take your hose at a strong blast. Well, this will make it mechanically easier for you to do that. I've used my thumb many times, but these definitely do a better job. So if you start to get white flies, you start to get aphids, you get more mites on there, that's what enables you to give the kind of simple pest control that we highly recommend here at the Davis Garden Show. Wash the plants off really vigorously, but then you can take it and make it more dispersed to give a good soaking. So one thing you could do pretty quickly to help these plants. Anyway, sorry about the problem. Let's move on to today's problems, which are all weather related.
So I'm going to start with a tomato disease question that we got from Annie. And the first one, which was the August 3rd message, we actually covered on the show. She had some pictures and we covered it. And then she sent us another message on the 22nd. And that was, let me read that. Hi to my brilliant, honorable garden gurus, Don and Lois. All right. You know, praise will get you everywhere.
Flattery will get you everywhere, I believe is the phrase. Yes.
Thank you for your suggestion about my tomatoes. I have followed through with your watering and side dressing suggestions from your show on August 6th. As a side note, my raised beds are on soil and are protected from the gophers by wire cloth at the bottom. That's very smart.
Yes.
I wanted to give my tomatoes a couple of weeks to see if they could respond to the deep watering and food before I murdered one of them to check for root problems. They haven't improved, so my dear non-gardener husband did the dastardly deed. Yep. I rinsed off the roots for a better visibility and looked up root knot nematodes, but I'm still not positive whether it's the issue. I'm attaching pictures and hope that you might please be able to enlighten me. Thank you for all your help.
Those are great pictures.
So the roots are great, and I don't see any knots. Do you see any knots?
No, the nodules for root knot nematode are really very obvious when you have them. And most people, if you go to ucanr.edu or any other site like that, you will find pictures that will make it clear to you that you don't have them on these plants. So that's good news. That means you're not having a long-term problem with root knot nematode. That's a challenging thing when you get it, and I don't, we'd have to have a long conversation about how to manage that. Then there were subsequent pictures there, right?
Yes. Then on the 24th, she sent another email saying, I just heard the most recent episode of your Davis Garden Show, and you mentioned that Juliet tomato is resistant to almost all diseases. Just in case I don't have root nematodes, I was wondering if you think my tomatoes might have some sort of blight. I'm attaching new pictures with my surviving early girl tomatoes and my healthy Juliet. They are in the same bed and have been treated the same.
Yep.
Many, many thanks for your patience from your grateful gardener, Annie in San Rafael.
Nice,
and
healthy looking
pictures.
Plant. Yeah. Nice, healthy looking plant. The Juliet is doing great. I see you looked at it and said you counted.
Yeah. Over 30.
Yeah. And this is a Juliet is a phenomenal tomato. I mean, it really produces well. I don't know all of the different diseases it's labeled for being resistant to, but I've never seen a disease problem on Juliet. And this gets to our biggest issue with what's going on
And
here.
it's small. It's small fruited.
Yeah. It's a little tiny fruit. It's the size of a cherry tomato, but it's more elongated. It's kind of, they call it plum shaped, which is odd. And they're meaty. They're not a, like most cherry tomatoes are very juicy and just used for fresh eating. These are meaty enough that you can actually use them in salsa, sauces, things like that. They hold together reasonably well. Also, you can freeze them whole. One of the reasons I've always loved Juliet is if I'm really in a hurry and I'm processing all the bigger tomatoes, you can take your Juliet, spread them out on a cookie sheet, put them in the freezer, freeze them solid, put them in thick Ziploc bags and store them whole and use them later on. And when you put that little frozen Juliet under a stream of water, the peel comes right off. So they're very handy for a lot of purposes. And if you got 500 fruit, you may decide to freeze some of them. It tends to produce really, really heavily. I'm glad we held off a week on answering this. We were going to do this for last week's show because this looked like a pretty urgent situation. 3 days ago, I walked through my own garden after we had some drizzly, spitty kind of rain, the kind of rain that just spits, doesn't really soak. And I saw some spots on some of the leaves of a couple of my plants. I get late blight occasionally. I get Septoria leaf spot occasionally, and sometimes even early blight at the start of the season, but they almost never do much. They pretty much go away. If I think of it, I'll pick those leaves off and dispose of them, but generally, I don't have to worry too much about it. I sent Lois a picture of what I
Yeah,
found
I nearly fell over when I saw
yesterday
that stuff.
morning when I
It
walked
is
out,
horrible.
and I took this picture this morning, and I walked out and took a picture. This is a variety called Squisito. It's fun. I was actually going to recommend it highly because it's done very well for me this year. How would you describe the condition of that plant?
Almost dead.
Yeah, dry.
The fruit is still there. I see a couple of red ones and a couple of green ones and a couple of orange ones, I
In
guess.
between, yeah.
But the stems and the leaves are brown and dried and crispy, and it's like, whoa.
Yeah, and I went in and took some closer pictures of individual leaves and individual places on the stem. This is late blight. And I do think that her problem is on the early grill tomatoes is late blight. Late blight is a disease, well known. It's a very famous disease, actually. Caused a lot of demographic changes in the United States when it hit the potatoes in the mid-19th century. This is Phytophthora infestans. Great name. Phytophthora
Infestans, like
infestans.
infested?
Yep,
Oh
because
my goodness.
this was the blight that got into potatoes, caused all the potatoes in storage to rot in Ireland, Norway, Sweden, other parts of Europe. It hit very quickly. People went out to look at their stored potatoes and they were all rotted, and it caused famine and, of course, mass migration of people to the United States. Phytophthora infestans affects members of Solanaceae, which includes potatoes, also tomatoes. Can affect others that you would be growing, peppers and stuff, but primarily the concern is with those two. And with tomatoes, it splashes. I've stepped back and I don't know how to take a picture of this, but I'll try. The plant this is badly affected is the picture I sent to Lois. The next plant to the south of it has some late blight, just part of one branch on the side closest to this. The next plant has a little bit on the part of the plant closest to this. So as you go down the row, you can almost see how the spores of this splashed or blew right on down the line. This is my tomatoes 6 feet away, and the next line over, my rows happen to run north to south, no problem at all. But it just came in on one plant somehow and moved rapidly down, evidently on a north wind, would be my best guess, or perhaps a south wind. But whatever it was, it went right on down the row. This is going to be very bad in the Sacramento Valley and San Rafael, of course, anywhere in the Bay Area where you've been getting this kind of drizzly rain. And I just popped up the weather over at San Rafael, and you're looking at drizzly rain, which is going to continue to spread this problem. I'm going to be removing that plant after we finish recording this broadcast. That's what I'm going to do, partly because I have 35 tomato plants and I can take it out and I won't be missing any tomatoes. The
And you're
ones.
going to cut off the bits that are damaged on the other
Yeah, I'll just
plants.
walk along. It's a branch here, it's some leaves there. I'll get as much of that off as I can. And those are actually going to go away. They're not going to just be, I usually just pile up this stuff. I'm out in the country. I just pile it up and make a quasi compost pile. I'm not going to do that with this. This is going to go away to perhaps my neighbor's burn pile or something. Who knows? It'll be gone from the vegetable garden. That much I
So
know.
what about all the tomatoes that are on there? I mean, if you're going to take that plant out, are those tomatoes just Does the thing affect the tomatoes? I know it affects potatoes, but does it affect tomatoes?
It can affect the tomatoes. What happened with potatoes is potatoes are in cold storage at low temperatures, and this particular Phytophthora can tolerate low temperatures relatively, and they're in storage where it's just moist. I mean, it's not wet, but there's no way you can avoid moisture when you're storing things like potatoes. They're putting them in bins and who knows what, sawdust or something. If one rotten potato went in there, it would spoil the entire bin. Potatoes, it can be a real disaster. Tomatoes, it hits the leaves, causes dieback. Eventually, it can hit the fruit. I have a picture here of fruit that has been hit by late blight, but it's never hit any of mine, perhaps because I just remove it as fast as I see it. But you can pick fruit that has no blemishes, and you can ripen it on the counter if it's not yet fully ripe. I've been doing that much of the season for a lot of my tomatoes, thanks to turkeys and ground squirrels. Well, here's another reason to do it. Bring them in, wash them, pat them dry, give them 3 or 4 days on the counter, and they'll be fully ripe. If you have a plant you're taking out because of late blight and the fruit is even off of dark green, it will ripen. And if it's anywhere close to yellow or orange, it'll definitely ripen anywhere from 3 to 7 days, depending on where it was in the ripening process and other factors.
So you sent me a picture or showed me a picture of a tomato that had a spot on the side.
Yeah.
It didn't look good. And that was from back east. Is that kind of damage something we could get?
Hypothetically, I've not generally seen it get this far along, but this is one of the worst sudden outbreaks of late blight that I've seen here. So it could. And the picture is from the University of Connecticut Extension. One of the funny things about this is I found reasonably good information at our ucanr.edu, but the East Coast Extension folks have lots of information about it because this is one of their major problems. It is a big deal for people gardening in places where it rains during the summertime. So the effect on the leaves and the stems is usually first. And if you catch that, your fruit can be okay, especially if you can get better airflow through there and don't overhead water, all that kind of thing. There's a lot of things you avoid doing when you're dealing with late blight. Cool, wet weather favors the development of the disease. As they say here, cool, wet weather favors the development of this disease that contributed to the Irish potato famine with newer strains since the 1990s, which may increase severity and fungicide resistance. So back east, this is a big issue. We generally don't have a lot of problems with it, but this year we are having problems suddenly. And if it's showing up, if you've got dieback on part of your tomato plant, you've got two choices. You can prune it out if the plant is otherwise basically healthy. Let's say 3/4 of the plant is fine or more. It's in distinct areas and you can prune it out. You got fruit that's getting closer to ripening. Maybe you'll just want to prune that out, get rid of it, save, let the fruit ripen, see how things go as we get further on into the month and into October. We certainly have plenty of fruit ripening potential period here. Or if it's bad, like the picture I sent to Lois, that plant is going to be cut off at ground level and removed this afternoon. Now I'll pick the few fruit that are still on there and that'll be the end of it for that plant, unfortunately.
So how fast does this spread? In other words, if you walk out and you see, like as you did, a twig here and a branch there on some of your other tomatoes, is that part that's diseased going to run into the rest of the plant in a day, or only by spores? How does it function?
That once in the plant, it can spread pretty quickly. And that picture I showed you, I took about 3 days after I noticed the first initial infection on that plant. So it went from some spots, some leaf die back to half the plant dead in a matter of 3 days. That's once it's in the plant. Spreading is wind and rain. And so we had a few years back where there was a lot of rain back east in the spring and there was some late blight on some plants that got planted. A storm would come in and the entire row of young plants would get wiped out. It can spread that quickly when you have the right storm conditions to spread the spores. We don't have that here typically. We had enough of it to get this going. And the reason I mention this now is there's a slight chance of rain, in the next couple of days in the Bay Area, there's going to be drizzle. So if this is a problem, in Southern California, of course, if that tropical storm veers in and hits you, it's going to spread all kinds of diseases, including specifically late blight on your tomatoes. So watch them, monitor, monitor, monitor. That's one of our mantras here. And if you see these spots on the leaves or a short area of dieback, prune it out as quickly as you can, because you can prevent it from spreading further. Once it gets in, you've got a major problem like I have on this plant, it's coming out. And I think Annie's situation, her early girls, by now, since we waited a week, are probably looking pretty rough. And my guess is it'll be pick the fruit, put them on the counter, ripen them on the counter, and cut those plants to the ground and get them out of there, or pull them out if you prefer to do that. This is a case where I don't think it makes that much difference. Cutting them off would probably be fine. I don't think it's going to overwinter on the roots, but I do suggest you get everything out of there. Managing late blight is very challenging. The sites will pretty much tell you that there aren't really any fungicides for this. And the reason for that is, I mean, there are, but they're more for agriculture than for home gardeners. The reason there aren't many products for it is this is not a fungus. Phytophthora, I would remind you, is a water mold. Water molds are not fungus. They have a different life cycle. They have those motile spores. Keep that in mind. That's kind of a startling thought that a plant has spores that can swim. There are three major Phytophthora, so it can be a little challenging to Google this topic. Phytophthora infestans is what we're talking about. Phytophthora ramorum is sudden oak death, killing trees up and down the coast. Phytophthora cinnamomai is one we're always referring to when we talk about crown and root rot. Different pathogen, kills plants in warm temperature conditions from overwatering, term we hate, but watering too often, trapping moisture around the ground. We'll get back to that one shortly with another question that came in. But this one in particular attacks members of the nightshade family. Some are resistant. There are seed catalogs, and you can read through there, Burpee and Harris Seed and Johnny's, and they'll often mention late blight resistance because this is a big deal for gardeners west of the Mississippi. And it is apparently a big deal for us occasionally. So that is
east of the Mississippi.
What did I say? Oh, did I say west? Yeah. Big problem for gardeners east of the Mississippi. Yes. For us, west of the Mississippi, which is kind of the dividing line for rainfall in the United States, usually not a problem. But that resistance might be something to look for. And they mention it on some modern hybrids. But this is also something that I'm going to start trying to make more observations about. Because as I walk down the row, I have some varieties that are completely untouched. There's not even a hint of late blight on them. Champion has nothing going on. This Hawaiian variety that the seed was given to me by a customer, Haleana, nothing. It's completely clean. The early girls have a little bit, but it's not as bad. But they do have some, so it's important to note that. So those of us who like to make notes year to year in our journals about our tomatoes, maybe start making some notes in the Sacramento Valley and also interior Southern California and the Bay Area about late blight problems and resistance that you observe.
Okay, so if I've got it right, tomatoes and potatoes either are now or have in the past been a problem with this late blight.
Indeed.
Are there any other members of the family that are susceptible? I don't know. Tomatillos, are they tomatoes?
Yeah, tomatillos and peppers and stuff. One of the simplest things you can do is make sure there are no weedy members of the nightshade family growing around your vegetable planters because they might be harboring it and carrying it over. And that includes anything in the nightshade family. So hypothetically, eggplant, tomatillo, basically, you're already at least hopefully trying to rotate those from one bed to another from year to year. It'd be great to do that. Make sure that you don't, obviously you're not going to plant in this bed with members of the nightshade family next year. You want to rotate so that you don't have things that are susceptible to this disease as well as Verticillium fusarium nematodes. So you do that 2 to 3 year rotation if you possibly can. I understand a lot of you don't have room for that. But the other thing is to look for the resistant varieties. So you're already maybe looking for VFN varieties in some cases. Look for some of the newer ones that are resistant to leaf blight diseases as well. And also observe. If you find some that do well for you consistently, as I've been, you know, like Juliet, it's a good example, be sure to plant some of those. This is one of the real key reasons we always tell you at the beginning of the season, broaden your portfolio, diversify your choices. Don't put in 6 of one thing, put in 6 different varieties. And you may be pleasantly surprised when we have a problem like this, that 1 or 2 varieties come through just fine. Make note of that and remember that for next year. There's probably a dozen tomato varieties that I always plant every year because they're consistent, reliable and consistent. And generally speaking, disease resistance would be one of the things I'd be looking for. Speaking of Phytophthora.
Oh, Don, do we have to? Yeah. Okay, so.
Different species, but yeah.
I thought you said that Phytophthora. Oh, different species of Phytophthora.
Yeah. And a different species of plant. Totally different family here. We got a letter from
Benjamin. Yeah. And Ben writes, good morning. I grew up working summers at small farms in New Hampshire and Vermont and moved to Sacramento 3 years ago. Switching from zone 3B to zone 9B has been, well, exciting and humbling. That's a good description. Yeah.
Let me tell you, for me to move from zone 9B to zone 3B would be very humbling.
Yes, and not terribly exciting. A lot of work, though, very challenging. Yeah. And the reason we're saying that, of course, is that New Hampshire and Vermont are very cold in the winter, and they have a totally different climate and, I don't know, growing seasons.
Yes.
So Sacramento, we have a summer season and a winter season. And then, of course, you've got things that are there all the time. So let me keep reading on this. I wanted to ask about this Daphne in the northeast corner of my front yard in Sacramento. When I moved in 3 years ago, it smelled amazing the first winter and appeared to be doing well. I was impressed, not previously being familiar with this plant. Now it looks terrible. There is a turf sprinkler head basically at the base of it, which I suspect is not helping. My question, is it worth the effort to relocate the turf sprinkler head to the edge of the turf, that is further in on the corner, so it isn't soaking this plant, and plant a new Daphne in the corner? Or is this spot too difficult for a Daphne to establish? The dilemma is exacerbated because the alternative would be to plant turf grass in the corner. And I am guessing it would not be easy to get turf grass growing because it is so close to that sycamore trunk.
Yep.
Would there be any advantage to building an edge with bricks or similar to terrace and isolate the corner Daphne from the turf? I am thinking that might be aesthetically pleasing as well. I'm attaching an old Google Street View of the spot from 2021 before I moved in. I'm guessing the Daphne was planted in 2021. Thanks for your thought. I love the show, especially your breakdown of the weather in the first few months. It is teaching me a lot.
Yeah, the climate would be the first thing you'd need to learn about moving to any place, and then the soil. And those both come into play here. The soil in our region is agricultural, silty to sandy, sometimes clay loam, depending on where you are. Now, I'm not sure exactly where in Sacramento, but in general, our soils are denser and hold water longer than, I don't know the soils of New Hampshire and Vermont, but I'm guessing, since I did at least see soil in New York.
Rocky and granite.
Yeah, my grandmother's property near Tarrytown, soil was gravel plus leaf mold. It was pretty amazing. I actually went out in the rain and planted things in her soil. There's no way I could particularly do that on my property because it would just be too muddy. So you have soil that holds water, which is great. That's something to get used to and how to water, but that does mean that it can stay damp around the crown of a plant. Yeah, especially if you're watering too frequently for that particular type of plant, and lawn watering and Daphne would not be compatible. It's just that simple. And even if you move the sprinkler head, I suspect that the drainage pattern here would bring moisture around the plant anyway. It's a challenging spot. We deal with this all the time where you have a city street tree is what it looks like right near the curb or right near the sidewalk. And you have those funny little corners that are created by them where turf just isn't going to grow real well, no matter what. Root competition from the tree, shade from the tree, distribution of water from your sprinklers will all be problematic. We've solved that sometimes by selling daylilies. Or something like that. Just fill it with some tough, indestructible perennial that if you happen to mow them by accident, that'll be fine. They'll bloom. They can take the more intermittent water that might be the case. You wouldn't necessarily even have to move the sprinkler head. You can maybe convert it to a drip bubbler for those, or just put them in there and see how they do, because they're indestructible. Hey, I've got an idea. Head up to Amador Flower Farm.
Yeah.
Amador County. They're having a real deal on daylilies as they close up. Get some of their really cool daylilies and put those on the corner down there.
So I'm looking at one of his pictures shows the lawn, the tree in the middle of the lawn, and then this Daphne in the corner. And the corner's between the sidewalk and the driveway, it looks like. So I'm thinking that sprinkler, I don't know if you all are familiar with it, but you can have a sprinkler where the sprinkler head has an extender that when it comes on, it pops up and sprays out, and it would be up high enough that it wouldn't kill the daylilies.
Right.
But I agree with Don. This corner is a challenge for that poor Daphne. And looking at the pictures, I mean, we weren't even sure it was really a Daphne at the beginning because well, there's so few leaves. Yeah. I mean, oh, poor thing.
So the thing, no.
I don't think Daphne could be moved, could it?
No, that'd be very, well, the thing you need to understand is that Daphne is probably the single plant most vulnerable to water molds I can think of. Water molds being primarily Phytophthora cinnamomae, but also Pythium and Rhizoctonia and some others. Daphne is famous for this. The Sunset Western Garden Book, describing winter Daphne, Daphne odora, so much loved so prized for the pervasive pre-spring fragrance of its flowers that it continues to be widely planted in spite of its unpredictable behavior. Actually, its behavior is very predictable. If water is trapped around the crown at all during high temperature periods, Phytophthora will attack crown rot, and crown and root rot is what we call that, Phytophthora cinnamomi, and the plant will die, and there's nothing to be done. Once it starts to yellow and drop the leaves, it is simply going to progress and die fairly quickly. And there's really nothing to be done to prevent it in terms of treating with anything. Lois, how many Daphnes have you planted?
I've killed two of them, actually.
I've killed four.
After killing the second one, I thought, this is just not a plant that's going to like to live with me.
It's a cruel punishment for the plant. Yes, I have killed four. And it's because I actually, in two of them, I got them well established. They're a couple of years in the ground and they're doing well. And then I made the biggest mistake you can do with Daphne. I planted some things nearby. I watered them, and you're watering the Daphne. And the next thing I know, once it starts to yellow, the leaves start to wither. It's gone at that point. There's no bringing it back from that. So as they say, they are very much loved. The fragrance is incredible, but you do have a very high mortality rate in the nursery industry as well as in landscapes and gardens. When we have planted them for or with people and been successful at it, when we were landscapers, they would be on a slight slope, which is not something we naturally have here. So we would be creating a slight slope, or they'd be up on a mound. And by a mound, I would recommend to the customer, and we would implement this, about a foot at least mound. And they're on the high part of that mound. You do need to make a little basin to get the young plant established. But from that point forward, once established, you want any excess water to drain away from the crown. They need moisture. They're not particularly drought tolerant. They're okay with normal watering. They do need to be watered, and the water has to leave the area around the plant as soon as it is applied. So soak in or drain off, fine. Standing there at all, you're really asking for trouble.
This sounds like a plant that would do well in a large planter. Is that true?
Yes, as long as you can keep it watered in a large planter. As a woody plant, it would probably at that point need daily watering, which is, I know, sort of contradictory to what we seem to have been saying, but that's because the soil in a container is almost sure to be very fast draining. In fact, if you plant it in a container, I would use either cactus mix or citrus mix, because those are going to be more mineral-based soils that'll drain more quickly. The most successful Daphne I ever saw in a backyard was in about a, 16-inch redwood tub that had been in for at least 20 years, sitting on the lawn, getting watered with the lawn, but sitting on the lawn. So it was getting watered with the lawn sprinklers, and the water would then drain right on through. And the reason the lady had me come out and look at it was she wanted to know if she could move it. And my reaction,
those roots should be in the ground way
down there. My reaction was apparently very funny, because I widened my eyes and said, don't even say that in its presence, because Daphne is so famous for dying. It had been obviously rooted into the soil, and at the point was keeping it alive, aside from the nearly daily watering with the sprinklers, was that that water did not stick around, and so it just drained right on through, and it obviously rooted into the ground. It was in the light shade of a walnut tree. It was 6 feet across, 4 feet tall, and she said when it bloomed, the neighbors would come over and want to know what was making that amazing fragrance, because all of them could smell it. And so her question, can I move this? I said, no, if you try to do anything to this, it's almost certain to kill it. Interesting fact, I knew the people who bought the house later, and the Daphne was still there, and they retained it. So my advice to them, since the tub was finally falling apart, was build a planter around it. Leave it in place. Take some blocks or something, build up around it, fill them with a very similar type of soil. Then you can gradually, carefully take away that planter. I have no idea whether this works, because I haven't talked to them in quite a while. But for many, many years, that plant was successful. Generally speaking, a 3 to 5 year lifespan is not uncommon for Daphne because of the crown rot. They can live a long time, but they're very vulnerable to these water molds. Daphne are wonderful. I would suggest you find another place in your yard for it, because that'll be a really challenging spot for a Daphne. Great spot for some tough perennial that'll just give you a season of bloom and then just be low care from that point forward. Then you don't have to worry about your sprinklers.
Daylilies. Yeah, I agree. Daylilies. And you know, if you wanted to, in the daylilies in the back next to the lawn, you could stick in a naked lady. And that would surprise the heck out of people in August. Suddenly, whoa, what's that thing?
I'm reminded of a consultation I did years ago where the lady wanted more garden and the husband, who was not present, did not want more garden. He liked the lawn. She wanted more space for flowers. And I said, okay, well, this is how you do this. You sneak it in. Okay, first thing is around the tree, you make a little bed because, you know, it's hard to plant lawn around the tree. You can show them. It's been really hard to get the lawn established here. So some daylilies, some agapanthus, whatever in that group you like. It's a pretty common category. And then, because that looks great, you widen the bed along the sidewalk by a couple feet and you put some more cool perennials or some low shrubs in there. And I'm very happy to report that a few years later, I drove by and there was about a 4 to 6 foot deep border all the way around the lawn. Mm-hmm. So she had prevailed, but it took a couple of years. So sometimes, you know, your spouse.
And she was nice. She left a lawn for him.
Yeah, he still had the lawn. She had her flowers. Great. Gardeners do need to compromise.
And a new message came from Donna. Thank you for being a wonderful resource to the Davis community. Would you please share your expertise regarding how flowers will fare during the winter in Davis? Specifically, one, is it possible to get flowers such as ranunculus and snapdragons to bloom throughout the winter using a low tunnel? Hmm. I don't know about a low,
just a miniature greenhouse-like thing. We call them tunnels. It's just basically take a hoop of PVC or something and you run plastic over it. So it's not a heated greenhouse. It's just one, keeping rainfall off of the plants and so that you don't get disease problems on them, protects them, boosts the heat a little bit so they grow a little bit better, and to some degree even protects them from pests. So hoop houses, as we call
them. That's what we used to call cold frames.
Well, it's similar. Yeah, it's the same idea. Yeah.
So ranunculus and snapdragons, do they both bloom at the same time? I thought ranunculus were spring.
It's kind of funny. This is actually a very complicated question. It turns out because those two choices are unique. Ranunculus are grown from a bulb-like structure that you put in the ground, and they're generally planted in the fall. But I do have growers that also plant them in greenhouses in midwinter for sale in the spring. If you get them planted early, you can get some winter bloom on them here, but not reliably. So I wouldn't want you to count on that. If we happen to have a wet winter, the flowers can ball up and get botrytis on them. So that's where the hoop house would be helpful, just to protect the blooms themselves. But they would definitely not be my first choice for something to grow for midwinter. You plant them for bloom, as you say, late winter, spring. Some places sell them in the spring, by the way. It's one of those bulbs where if you go to bulb catalogs and they're East Coast focused, they're going to put them in the subtropical warm area bulbs in the back of the catalog. They're really more of a California specialty. In fact, the very best ranunculus starters would always come from California. There were growers down the Lompoc region that grew them. Phenomenal, huge bulb-like. I keep saying that. I'm going to tell you exactly what a ranunculus is. I can't remember whether it's a corm.
Well, it doesn't look like a bulb. It has these little fingers coming out of it.
Little prongs pointing downward. And that's the important part. They point downward. Ranunculus is a tuber. Okay, thank you, Sunset Western Garden Book. And they have prongs that are just water storage units. And those have to be down. If you put them up, it'll take a lot longer because it has to reorient itself. So you put them prongs down. We find ourselves doing that, illustrating to the customer, prongs down. Only important thing you need to know about ranunculus. But you're not going to get them to bloom in the midwinter. They'll probably bloom late winter into spring. And it's not a long bloom, but boy, are they worth it. I mean, they're perfect. They look like roses. I mean, they're beautiful, heavily doubled flowers, strong colors, easy to grow. In this area, we sell them as a cool season annual. Even though there's a tuber there, generally speaking, people have a lot of trouble getting that to go from year to year. So you just buy new ones each year. Snapdragons. Snapdragons were once a florist crop. Once upon a time, people primarily grew snapdragons for long stems for cutting. They are still a florist industry crop to some degree. They're a long day plant. So you can plant them in that hoop house if you're doing them for that kind. Long stemmed snapdragons, you plant in the fall. Make basal shoots. You pinch them back if you want even more of those. Don't worry about it if you don't. They grow through the winter, so they don't need that hoop house at all because they're fine with our cold and our rain and all that kind of stuff. They initiate flowering as the days are getting longer, which means they don't initiate flowering until the end of winter or February, March, and they bloom heavily here late March, especially April, and especially May. That's when cut flower snapdragons bloom best for me. Those are the old-fashioned kind. So long about the 1950s or 60s is my guess, day-neutral snapdragons were developed or came upon their own, either way. That means they don't need longer days or shorter days. They're not photoperiod sensitive. They will just initiate blooms X number of weeks after planting. Most of those are dwarfer plants. They're very compact growers. So you go into any nursery from about October through May, and you will find snapdragons in bloom. floral carpet, Tahiti series, sonnets, which only get 16 to 18 inches, even the longer stemmed ones that are out there, although they're not as big as the old fashioned ones, are day neutral. So you can plant them anytime and they'll initiate bloom. The thing is, in our climate, if you plant them in the fall, even in a hoop house, they'll put up one or two spikes in the fall and winter, which is fine. And you don't need the hoop house for that. And then they will be flushing from the base and give a heavy bloom in the late winter and spring. They still follow the same pattern as their predecessors, but they give the earlier bloom as well. So go ahead, you'll be buying them in bloom. This has become a big deal for the bedding plant industry. You can walk into a Lowe's or a Home Depot midwinter and find snapdragons in full bloom. You can take those home and plant them. They won't initiate new flowers probably till February or March, but they'll have those blooms that are on there, and the blooms that you bought them with will hang on for a couple of weeks at least. So they're a different kind of plant than they used to be. You don't need a hoop house for them in this climate at all. They are absolutely fine out in the winter cold, in the fog, the dreary weather is absolutely fine with snapdragons. They're just gearing up, making a lot of basal shoots, getting ready to grow and bloom for you next spring, although there are some that bloom right on through the winter.
Two questions, Don. First is, those snapdragons sound wonderful, especially those short ones. Yeah. Can I grow those in the house this winter?
You can't grow flowers in the house.
Okay, never mind.
Good thought, though. Worth a try. You can grow orchids in the house.
Yeah, whatever. So other than snapdragons and ranunculus, what could she grow to bloom in the winter?
Well, if we have 40 days of 40-degree foggy weather, nothing is going to be blooming. So that was anomalous, but it does happen. I remember when I first moved here, when you first moved here, that was common. We had that long spell in December where it was so dreary that even things that were blooming stopped blooming. The things that give us color in the winter are cyclamen, pansies, violas, the dwarf snapdragons. Stock to some degree, although stock actually follows the same pattern as snapdragons. There's just varieties that bloom earlier. Those are all things that will bloom right on through the winter. My concern is with El Nino threatening, it's obviously, as you've seen on the news reports, this is one of the biggest anomalies they've ever seen. This is going to be a very powerful El Nino. The typical pattern is that means a lot of storms, and that means a lot of moisture and a lot of days that aren't sunny. Overcast, cloudy days, plants aren't growing. They're not initiating flowers. But more to the point, with that moisture, a lot of things blooming midwinter, the flowers will mold. You'll get botrytis, gray mold on the flowers. So if I were choosing between cyclamen, for example, I wouldn't buy the florist cyclamen with the big leaves and big fleshy petals unless I was going to put them where they're out of the rain, because they will mold very quickly. They need to be bright conditions, but rainfall constantly on florist cyclamen, as we call those in the business, will cause a lot of the flowers to mold. They'll be very unattractive. The miniature cyclamen that have come on the market seem to be much less prone to botrytis. Partly, perhaps, they hold their flowers up high enough that there's good air circulation. I don't know. But whatever it is, I've had much better results with those right out in the open, even in rainy winters. They stopped blooming last year because of the dreary cold, but they didn't mold. And so they would be a better choice if you're choosing cyclamen, and we really like them here. But I do mention pansies and violas. Of the two, big old fleshy petaled pansies,
yeah,
clear to get botrytis. Worth growing, but likelier to get botrytis.
Yeah.
The violas and the viola hybrids that they've actually crossed with pansies hold their flowers up better, better air circulation, much less prone to it. So they'd be my first choice for something for just automatically easy color midwinter here. And they wouldn't need any protection of any kind.
Well, if flowers are going to be so much of a challenge, what have you got that would be leaves that are beautiful and bright and cheerful? And I mean, don't we have plants like that we can grow without the flowers?
Yeah, kale. And I'd say kale, even, you know, the edible type, sure. Actually, red Russian kale is a very attractive plant. Many of the others are very ornamental. And there's also ornamental kale and cabbage. I don't know if you remember those years ago. They were really big in the 80s and 90s. Some growers still do.
And they were really big.
Yeah, they turn into a
huge
cabbage. They're kale or a cabbage. They're a different strain, actually, that was developed in Japan, if I recall, as an ornamental. Yes, they're edible. Most common question we get when we would sell those, are these edible? Sure, they're kind of fibrous, not particularly tasty. Honestly, a lot of people feel that way about kale in general, but they're perfectly edible. They're colorful. And here's the thing, after about 7 or 8 weeks in the ground, they'll flower, as many brassicas will. a lot of people get upset and want to pull them out. The flowers are pretty. Leave them. Let them have the nice yellow mustard flowers and enjoy those as well. But kale is another possibility. Yeah. And there's lots of things with colorful foliage in the wintertime. There's a lot of plants where their leaf color changes as we get into the winter. And there are a lot of succulents that have great color in the winter. In this area, you're now in a place where you can grow a very attractive succulent that has great winter appearance, the aeoniums. They're actually cool season preferring succulents. They are getting ready to flower in the late winter, and they make these great big rosettes that are most attractive in midwinter and into the early to mid spring. So those are something you can add. And I'm happy to see more people planting succulents in with other perennials rather than having like, here's my cactus and succulent garden over here, and here are the perennials and flowers over here. Aeonium mixes very nicely with other perennials. It gives a real dramatic contrast. So look for some of those. But yes, foliage color and fruit color are really kind of key parts of winter gardens, is to get that seasonal color on them.
So Donna continues with a second question. As we are forecasted to experience an El Nino winter, what can we do to prevent our bulbs from rotting in the rain? So is bulbs rotting a problem?
It can be. We have dense soil. So if you're in some parts of Davis or Woodland, I'd be a little concerned about it. If you're in Binning Tract, Stonegate, North Davis Meadows, and you have essentially unamended soil, it's going to hold a lot of water. There may be periods in which water is standing there for 12 to 24 hours. That would be a concern, not just for bulbs, for all kinds of things. Generally speaking, though, you don't have to worry that much about rot in the winter because the rot organisms are warm season phenomena. The Phytophthora that we talk about so much requires highly moist and high temperature conditions. So we have had years in the 80s, especially, where we had saturated soil for days and plants came through just fine. That same saturation had occurred in April. Many of those plants would have rotted. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that, but a very slight slope or elevation can make all the difference. You know, when you make a bed for anything, and anything we plant, we generally want to have it elevated slightly so any excess water percolates to an area that you've chosen for that purpose. So I highly recommend that we keep water on the property if we can to let it soak in and benefit the trees and so forth. So make bio swales or drain areas where you know the water is going to collect, and you don't plant bulbs or woody plants in those types of places. They'd be above those where water will drain down to them. There are plants you can plant in low areas where water collects. Acorus, sedges, all kinds of interesting riparian plants that can be used in those spots that would be unaffected by standing water. But I would just elevate. That's really the key. You don't really have to amend the soil. You just want water to percolate away when there's an excess.
So Wendell Berry, I don't know if you all, the listeners, know him, but this is an American poet, and he died August 31st at age 92, had a good long life. Yeah. I want to read a quote from him, a poem, in fact. I go among trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.